Welcome to the Virtual Velo Podcast, powered by the Zamunique. We are passionate about cycling and immersed in the virtual cycling community. I'm Chris Schwanker, a freelance cycling journalist, here to lend a voice to the digital athlete and bridge the gap between athlete and avatar. Take a conversational ride with us. Welcome to the Virtual Velo Podcast. This is Chris Schwanker back with
Cy Bradley.
Hey, Cy. We hadn't done one of these podcasts for a couple of months, and now it's 2 in 2 weeks.
Back to back. Yeah, it's like a week's training in the summer. Back to back events, on we go. But there's plenty to talk about, Chris. Plenty going on in the industry, I would say, right now. And of course, one of the reasons why we're here today is to talk about one of the new platforms. But before we get onto that, I've noticed you've been on this new platform and you've been putting in some big miles. I saw your first ride on the said new platform was like 160 miles or 160K, right?
I think it was closer to 160K. It was a proper century, a proper US century. I'd wanted to get on the platform. You know, I heard a lot about it, very excited, interviewed our guest a couple times, spoke to a bunch of the racers, and heard a million great things. But I run Zwift on an Apple TV, so I didn't have a computer. So I actually reached out to Timothy Rugg, the elite racer from Coalition. He built computers on the side, and I said, "Listen, can you get me a computer?" He's like, "Yeah, but I don't know if these parts are around. It's probably going to take forever." He built it in less than a week. I had it in less than a week. So and the thing is great. I'm technologically challenged, so it took me a while to set it up. But once I got it set up, I was like, you know what? This would be a really cool thing to do a nice ride on Father's Day as my first ride on this new platform, and we'll take it from there. And I'm not gonna tell you what I think. Not yet.
Not yet. Keep us in suspense. But that's not the first long ride I've seen recently from you. I think it was this time last year, right? You were doing the ride across the US. So is this just something you're just doing the same indoors now? What's the reason why you're putting in so many miles at this time of year, Chris?
The main reason is because I love to ride my bike, indoors, outdoors, wherever it is. That's the main reason. And I don't really need too many excuses or...
No, come on. You've got an event coming up, right? Tell me and tell the listeners, you've got an event coming up. I know you're in training for something.
Well, I like to do a challenge every year. Whether it be last year was a big one, riding across the country was a big challenge, but this year, I'm getting together with a couple of people, Gabriella Nordine, you'll know she did pretty well in the world championships, posed this challenge. And it's kind of funny because I was actually thinking about doing the same thing, but we're going to do an hour with every pace partner on Zwift. So it'll be 9 hours. We're going to run the gamut from, A to D and back and forth and mix it all up. So that'll be a nice way to my base training.
So is it nine pace? Is it nine pace partners? Is that right?
I think that there are nine pace partners, and I think some of them actually do rides in different worlds. So
yeah. I thought there was like nine in each, but maybe you're right. Maybe there's sort of Watopia and Mercury Islands, isn't there? But there's a few pace partners as well, so you've got to stick around with the big boys as well. I mean, you're a big boy yourself, but
see, I'm not organizing this, but I'm hoping that there'll be a D in between the A.
A little bit of recovery.
Yeah, but enough of that. We might as well. We got to bring our guest in here. Enough about me. If you want to introduce our guest, Cy, take it away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm really really excited actually to have today's guest on. Of course, it is none other than Dr. George Gilbert. Who has a CV and a LinkedIn profile longer than my arm, I have to say. And there's a lot of varied experience in there. So I'm looking forward to deep diving into that. But what do we call it? Dr. George? Dr. Gilbert? How are we going to refer to you today?
George, please.
George. Well, welcome to the podcast, George. It's great to have you here. It must have been an exciting couple of weeks because it seems to me the cycling esports community, there's been a lot of chat about this new platform.
Yes, it's been extraordinary, the uptake and interest in it. It's really exciting to be able to bring something new and start pushing the boundaries of what's possible with esports.
I mean, it's great. We're going to get onto this this new platform, which is called IndieVelo. We're going to deep dive as much as we can in the next hour into IndieVelo. But first of all, George, if you don't mind, I want to find out a bit more about you and your background. So let's start with the obvious from a cycling point of view, or your athletic background. What's your background in sport and cycling specifically?
Many and varied. I actually started off as a rower. I rowed at Cambridge University, rowed in one of the boat races and did a few minor international events there. But after leaving university, I foolishly got a job that wasn't anywhere near a river, but was right next to a velodrome. So I took up track cycling and became the one of the British regional individual pursuit champions, team pursuit champion. Eventually took up Derny pacing, was a 10 times British national champion at that, and represented Great Britain in the European Championships. Unfortunately, was very ill after that. And was forced to retire from elite sport, needed major surgery, but then took up running and as effectively as a para athlete, went on and competed in a few minor international running events, was awarded title of the global hero around kind of inspiring others to take up sport after life-changing surgery. Many and varied athletic career.
Well, I don't think that we should breeze over that. Maybe you can give us a little bit more about the health challenges that you've overcome, because I know they're extensive and they deserve to be acknowledged.
Yeah, I had something which is called a regurgitant congenital bicuspid aortic valve, which is an awesome title. But it essentially meant that when my heart contracted to pump the blood around the body, the blood would leave the heart. But when the heart expanded again, ready for the next beat, what it would do is it would just suck all the blood back again. So the blood would just swish around in the heart rather than actually going around the body. And that led to the point where eventually, I couldn't even climb a single flight of stairs without being out of breath. At one point, I was even given just 2 years to live. Fortunately, with major open heart surgery, I survived, and it's now, 12, 13 years later? In incredibly traumatic period of my life, it took 10 years and an awful lot of counselling to get through it.
I mean, there's so much an amazing story. I mean, I think just given your background from a sporting point of view, it's opened up so many questions, even before the health challenges you've faced there. But I guess what about the education? Because you mentioned you went to Cambridge, and obviously I hope our international listeners are well aware of the infamous or the famous boat race that takes place between those Oxford and Cambridge universities. But so you went to Cambridge. What did you study at while you were there?
So I eventually ended up with a PhD in astrophysics. But prior to that, had studied through mathematics and various disciplines in physics, so quantum mechanics, information theory, leading all the way through to, astrophysics, where I studied black holes and quasars, actually. You know those kind of artist impressions that you see every now and again of a black hole, and you've got this bright mass and then clouds swirling around and these enormous jets coming out of either side of the black hole. I studied those jets and ended up as a kind of world expert in how those jets interact with the surrounding galaxies. It's very much like if you imagine a hose pipe and a sand pit, yeah? So you've got this hose pipe and you're pointing it at the sand pit, and you can imagine it just burrowing a hole into the sand and sand flying everywhere. And that's basically what these jets are, except instead of grains of sand, each grain of sand is like an entire star system and planets. And these jets just power their way through entire galaxies, blowing stars out into the ether. It's absolutely fascinating stuff.
It's, yeah, clearly it's something you're really passionate about. Chris, I never thought we'd be on a cycling esports podcast talking about astrophysics and black holes.
Yeah, I am. All of a sudden, I feel really stupid.
I was already there, yeah.
But anyway, so that's a far cry from coding. You know, when did you get into that? You know, coding and the stuff that you need to know in order to create a virtual cycling platform.
Oh, I've been writing games since I was probably 7 or 8 years old. I think started out on something called a ZX81, ancient computers that brought out in the early 1980s with 1 kilobyte of memory. 1 kilobyte, that's like 1/1,000,000th of one gigabyte. You had literally 1,000 characters to write your entire program and everything in it. It just kind of really focused your mind on what was important and how to write really efficient code. And then over the years, I've kind of expanded on that, writing various indie games and eventually getting a job in the computing industry and writing server software that powered the global telephone network.
Well, that's really interesting to me that, you know, that has come up before when we've spoken. And, you know, can tell us a little bit more about that. The global so that's the 911 network, the emergency network that, of all the things that can't fail, that's one of the things.
Yeah, but very much so. It was the network that carries everything. So not the handsets or anything like that, but the bit that routes the call or routes the call for the US folks across the entire internet, such that it gets from one caller to another. And as you say, it's software that cannot fail because it carries all the 911 calls. And the time when you need to call 911 is exactly the time when it cannot fail. So you can get a major disaster, you know, an earthquake or what have you, and 100,000 people simultaneously dial 911 to bring in the emergency services. It cannot fail in that circumstance. So a lot of work went into trying to make sure that not just that the code worked, but it could never, ever go wrong.
So you were part of the coding team who built that system, is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Wow, I'm trying to think how we build this back into cycling, because it's such a background there. But tell us about, because I'm well aware, obviously I'm in the UK, you're based in the UK as well, you're British like me, but I know that you were part of the board of directors from British Cycling as well. So how did that come up? You know, how did you move from astrophysics and coding to getting into the cycling industry with British Cycling?
Well, as I said before, as a cyclist, I was racing and then was basically put into enforced retirement. Literally overnight, I went from training 3-4 hours a day, 13 days a fortnight, to you need to stop now. That was an interesting discussion with the doctors. And you know, that kind of withdrawal from the cycling world, I filled that void by putting back into cycling what I'd got out, volunteering as an event organizer, as a commissaire, and then kind of gradually worked my way into the infrastructure of how cycling works in the UK, through regional boards up to the national board, and eventually being the vice chair of the board of directors at British Cycling.
So you still had that passion and love for being on the bike and cycling, and that's what you... But, I mean, because those volunteers who regionally, who organise events, I mean, the hours those guys put in, and quite often free of charge as well. So you've basically come through that same system.
Yes, I absolutely.
And then you made the jump then from British Cycling, indeed, to working for the UCI as well, right?
I never actually worked for the UCI, but definitely with them. Part of my roles were around the technical commission at British Cycling, where I led the group that wrote the rule book for all the rules for all of the disciplines in cycling, and worked with the in anti-doping, actually, working with the anti-doping commission and making sure that the integrity of elite level sport was paramount through all of British Cycling's rules and policies and so on. And through that and the commissaring work, definitely had lots of touch points with the UCI throughout.
How did those circumstances lead to working with Zwift? You know, that you know, all of our audience wants, you know, that's we're a virtual cycling audience. So that's what's going to be, you know, most interesting to them. How did that lead into your position there?
I was actually at the World Road Championships in Harrogate, and there was a Zwift cycling booth there, and I was chatting with Eric Min in my capacity as the vice chair of the board of directors at British Cycling, and we were talking about my kind of technical background and the coding background and the governance of elite sport. And at that time, it was Zwift was very much looking at building on creating the elite sport side of the platform. They'd just got this massive influx of funding, 120 million or something. It was to build an esports side of their business, and they wanted somebody to kind of come in and as purely as an external consultant, but to advise them on what good governance looks like in running races. How do you act as a commissaire? How do you ensure that races are run properly? You know, what even are races? It's stuff that we take for granted as bike riders around, you know, what is a points race? What's a scratch race? And all of these kind of things that, say, we just, as cyclists, naturally know and pick up through osmosis. But helping Zwift kind of put on those events.
You mentioned that there was a commitment to esports, a financial commitment made at that time. What year was that that you joined the company?
I think that was 2019. Yes, it must have been because that's when the Worlds were at Harrogate.
So did you have goals in your mind where you'd want to take that commitment at that time?
It was very much about establishing credibility as a new discipline with proper governance structures, but putting esports on the map as opposed to just riding around casually and training. Zwift was built as a training platform originally, and as we all know, you know, you don't need anything else to get a race. You know, you put two cyclists on a road and there's a signpost in the distance, you have a race. You know, that's just how it works. But the ability to kind of put the infrastructure around it to be able to have proper organized racing was very much how I wanted to see things evolve.
Now, were you an employee of Zwift? Were you contracted by them? Were you a consultant? You know, what was your title and what was your role?
Yeah, external consultant. I was never employed by Zwift.
And what was your exact title there?
I was chair of the Cycling Esports Commission.
Now, at what point did Zada come into the picture? Was that an initiative that you created?
No, Zada existed prior to that. It was a volunteer group initially, and that kind of sprang up that must have been 2017 or something. It was a couple of years before I started as a volunteer group. And then that went through various iterations, and it eventually came in under Zwift. Because Zwift wanted to kind of own and control that group rather than it being a totally voluntary thing outside of their control. And obviously that makes sense from a legal perspective as well. It's not good to have a bunch of volunteers just running your platform for you.
Yeah, I could see how it would be good from the legal perspective, but not necessarily from the conflict of interest perspective. And I wonder if during your 4 years at Zwift and with the evolution, I'm sure you did a significant amount of great work there. I'm just wondering if that commitment that you felt when you first joined the company, whether that remained throughout your time there.
That was always the goal. And you bring up the conflict of interest thing, and that kind of comes on to why we eventually kind of ended up moving apart. And it started off actually with a conversation almost immediately after joining. I was sitting with Bjorn Ossenbrink, who was the head of Zada, and the head of the Zwift legal department, actually. And we were talking through about these kind of conflicts of interest. And actually, it was Zwift's head of legal that first suggested that actually we should really be a separate group, because we all recognize that clear conflict of interest of marking your own homework or grading your own homework in the US. And we felt that it was kind of like, let's take the Tour de France as an example. Let's imagine that ASO running the Tour de France, and instead of getting WADA to do all their anti-doping checks, ASO announced that actually we'll do it all. We'll do it all in-house. And you get to the end of the Tour de France and ASO announce, yep, it was all fine, it was all clean, no problems at all. And you can easily see in that kind of scenario that it just wouldn't have credibility. You just wouldn't believe them. Even if it was true, there'd be that lingering doubt about the credibility and what was the conflict of interest really overpowering those decisions about anti-doping. And we felt that even things like the name Zada was pretty problematic, because you've got the appearance of a Zwift group regulating Zwift. And so we came to this conclusion, to say that this was 3 years ago, that the group needed to split off and be a completely separate and independent entity from Zwift. But at the time, it was very much the case that the sport was still really young, it's really small. We needed that legal support from Zwift. And so we decided, look, let's keep going for a bit longer. But as the sport grows and matures, then we'll get to the point where we need to be separate entities. And so that's how it passed, with that kind of full knowledge, advice and blessing of Zwift, we set up as a separate body.
So you mentioned Bjorn Ossenbrink, the head of WADA, and yourself. You amicably parted ways, moved on from Zwift. After you left, was there anybody at the company in the capacity that could take over for you? Was Bjorn all of Zada? Were you all of the commission? Was there anybody else to take your place or that you could hand the mantle off to?
So Zada consists of Bjorn as head of it, but there were also a number of other people working within that group. So around half a dozen other people who did a lot of the analytic work. But yes, yeah, so all of us left at the same time, because as I said, this kind of conflict of interest was just getting too much. And with the idea of the potential for the Olympics on the horizon, and it was just really important to have that independent oversight.
I did an interview with the head of PR from Zwift, Chris Snook, and asked him these same questions. And he kind of doubled down on the fact that they're going to continue with business as usual. Zada is going to continue. It's going to continue to be a Zwift funded entity, and everything is hunky dory over here. It sounds to me like behind the scenes they wanted it to be separate. It's kind of a mixed message there. I'm curious how it's really being characterized.
That's something you'd need to take up with Zwift. As I say, that's what I've said is what happened. We've talked about this for multiple years, and it was suggested and initially driven by that desire from the Zwift's head of legal that it was the right thing to do to be a separate entity.
So I'm a bit confused. I don't know whether George or Chris, you can answer this for me. But so if everyone's left Zada, then Does it exist? Does it not exist? Is it an empty office somewhere? Who's marking the homework right now? We've got this Olympic series come up. I'm assuming the UCI is going to pick up that verification, but what's the status of play with Zada right now?
Again, that's something you'll need to ask Zwift about. In terms of the UCI, then we're talking obviously with the UCI in a lot of detail because right now they don't have any verification processes. So we're going to be working with them to work out what that looks like in the context of growing the sport.
Well, I think it's a perfect way to segue into speaking about IndieVelo, because it talks to your vision for creation. It talks to the reason why you've created it. So maybe you can just tell us, what your vision is, what your key pillars are, and what are the foundation that you put in place there, and the reasons why.
Yeah, of course, and it comes back to the strap line that we can put at literally the very first thing that you encounter when if you Google IndieVelo or come onto the website. Imagine if online cycling were an Olympic sport. I'm really literally just stop, think for a couple of seconds. Now, if you were watching online cycling at the Los Angeles 28 Olympic Games, what would that actually be like? What would you want it to be like? And let's go and build that. It was very much around this idea of specialization. So as the sport grows, any business, there's this realization that you can't do everything. Again, if you come back to the Tour de France example, it'd be like ASO building their own cars rather than getting Skoda in, or building their own timing system rather than getting Tissot in. You outsource specialist bits of work to companies that are specialists in those areas. And if you spread yourself too thin, you just can't please all the people all the time. So to be truly successful, you have to have a niche. Yeah, you've got to be truly world class in a really narrow field, and then get all the companies together who are all experts in their fields, and that's how you build something amazing. And for me, that area of specialism is that infrastructure for online cycling, the hardcore data processing, the coding that's required for performance verification, accurate real-time results, proper physics-based pack dynamics, analytics for doing global cross-platform rankings, multiplayer matchmaking, all of that kind of data stuff, all of the stuff beneath the hood, but is the beating heart of what makes esports a credible sport as opposed to being a game. Other people can do fancy graphics, but that's not what our specialism is. We provide the very best core cycling experience, and by lots of companies working together, each bringing what they're best at to the table, we have the opportunity to create something truly amazing here.
But what you're saying is your focus has been on the physics, the dynamics, the draft, and there's some other aspects and features in IndieVelo that are more akin to what we would see in cycling, like wind and so on. We're going to come back to that in a little bit, but just a real pragmatic question here: the IndieVelo is an organization right now. Is it you? How many people in this organization? Because I know we've already discussed you've got a really unique background here, but is this just yourself doing all the coding to get us to the point where we are now with IndieVelo?
Yes, bluntly, but that misses the point. So yes, it's a one person organization in terms of all of the coding, all of the design work, all of the publishing, all of that kind of stuff. And with Bjorn and the old Zada team, them doing all of the performance verification side of things. But actually, it's above everything else, IndieVelo is about a group of people who have come together with this vision of what cycling esports could be. it's not about having a community. It is a community of hundreds of cyclists, mostly elite racing cyclists, but plenty of other kind of club cyclists and so on as well, who really believe that racing online can be much better than what the existing infrastructure provides, and all working together and sharing ideas for how to make that happen. And yes, I'm the person who types out the code at the end of the day, but it is a massive community of people who are all driven by this kind of common desire to see cycling as a credible Olympic medal sport.
So you interviewed a lot of elite racers. What did they tell you that they wanted?
So it broadly came down to two groups of things, and they can be characterized by tactics and credibility. So by tactics, I mean that win or lose, your results when you're racing online should be based on your skills as a rider and not just your power. So things like your ability to position yourself in the draft, judge cornering speed, judging when to sit in or attack in the wind, you know, all these kind of decisions should affect the outcome of a race. And then in terms of credibility, it was around what you see and experience needs to be legitimate, proven athletic ability. So a lot of comments around having built-in performance verification, built-in dual recording, encryption in protocols, complete accuracy, precision, consistency of everybody's position in the world. Getting all of those things in place were really high on the list.
There are a couple of specific things that you built your foundation on, the building blocks. One was Unity, and another was your server authoritative structure. And the reason why I mention those both is that they're different than a lot of the other platforms. Can you explain why you've made those choices?
So Unity, using the Unity game engine, was very much around speed of iteration. With Unity, you can write a very small amount of highly focused code very quickly. So for example, over the last 6 months, we've averaged it's about one release every 3 days, every 4 days, I think we managed over a 6 month period. Just the ability to add a whole bunch of features very, very quickly, stick a release out and have it just work, meant that we could iterate incredibly quickly, try stuff out, see what worked, see what didn't, change it, and repeat over and over again. And that is kind of, that speed of development was really important to that kind of core mission of getting something up and running as quickly as possible. In terms of that server authoritative architecture, there are kind of two ways in which you can build a multiplayer computer game, and I genuinely mean any multiplayer computer game, and that includes Fortnite or Call of Duty or anything. One way is kind of server authoritative, and one way is client authoritative. Client authoritative architectures mean that everything is running on everybody's individual computer. So if you've got 100 people playing, then there are 100 different simulations running. And each one is slightly different because they've got different information. And it means that everybody sees a different view of the world. So maybe rider A sees themselves ahead of rider B, but rider B sees themselves ahead of rider A. Whereas with a server authoritative architecture, there is just one simulation, and that's what's running on the server. And that server basically broadcasts out to all of the clients, draw this. And so everybody sees exactly the same thing. And so when looking at building something for an Olympic event, that credibility of everybody seeing exactly the same thing was absolutely central to it. And you can just imagine the Olympics, yeah. Let's say a rider from the USA crosses the line first, and you know the whole US delegation sticks their arms up in celebration, and then a rider from Germany crosses the line half a second later to get the silver medal, and then up pops the results and it says that Germany won and USA were in second. And you can just imagine the lawsuits coming in should that sort of thing happen. It's just utterly essential that everybody sees exactly the same thing and there is just one true result.
I think we've all had that experience on other games, let me put it that way, historically. So it sounds like you've got this sort of proprietary system then, this race engine. So apart from the fact that it's what you see on screen is what you're going to get results-wise, that's the way my basic brain has worked this out. You know, what else is going to distinguish the dynamics of what you and the Indivelo team have built from the others out there in the market?
So I think that the other major thing is that tactical point. As I say, the things like the effect of wind has a really disproportionate effect on how the race dynamics plays out in practice. So it's not just about, there's maybe a bit more resistance, but it's about positioning yourself within the pack, making sure that you're taking rests at the appropriate point, making sure that you're judging your attack at the right point. Do you want to attack into a headwind? Do you want to go in a tailwind? Do you want to try and cross groups from one group to another? Because and when do you do that? Which bit of the course do you do that? What direction of do you want the road to be going in compared to the wind when you do that attack? There's just so many more tactical dimensions to how a race pans out that it just makes it so much more interesting and skill-based rather than just who can smash out the most number of watts.
So Chris, just before, because I know you've got some more questions potentially on the physics and how that technology might roll out moving forward, but I want to take this opportunity, if I can, George, just to give you a few rapid-fire questions, because you've mentioned wind and weather and how that plays a role. But I wonder if you can just give us a bit of insight. I'm going to fire off some features. I want to give myself and the listeners a bit of insight on this feature list. So we've done wind and weather. What about braking and cornering? Because when I've utilized the game, I've seen my light coming on and I've also seen my rider, or put it, it's felt different if I've hit the corner too hard. So tell me a little bit more about that feature.
Yeah, very much. It's an important part of this kind of idea of skill should be what helps determine the outcome of a race. So instead of kind of just smashing it as hard as you can into the corner and basically ignoring the terrain, when you come to a corner, if you're traveling too fast, then it will push you to the outside of the corner, increase the resistance on the trainer to kind of penalize your legs, so you have to kind of spin up harder at the end of it. And conversely, it rewards you taking a nice smooth line through. If you drop the power off, go through at an appropriate speed, then the trainer doesn't break your flywheel so that you can pick up speed again at the exit of the corner. Yeah. Again, it's just about ways of adding more skill into the game.
Yeah, mimicking how we would race if we raced a local town set at Centre Crit, for example. Okay, one of the things I've noticed, obviously, one of the key things that I do, if I'm coming to end of a race on the Zwift platform, for example, on the right-hand side, I watch for the numbers turning red, the watts per kilogram numbers on there, but I can't find those numbers on Indivelo. I can see speed and the speed changes, but I guess you've decided to remove the sort of the display of effort in the same way?
Yes, or more to the point, we've changed what the display of effort is. So as you rightly say, that we don't have watts per kilo, and that is an extremely deliberate decision for two reasons, actually. One is an issue around weight, actually, and I just philosophically believe that the focus on riders' weights is unhealthy for the growth of the sport. I think that where we got to over the last 3-4 years is that people obsess over other people's weights, and people obsess over their own weights, actually, to the point of it being pretty damaging psychologically for people to have that kind of focus, and the issue with eating disorders and so on. And yes, weight is absolutely an important part of how fast you go in an online cycling game, but I see no benefit to broadcasting it out publicly to everybody. And secondly, I think that it's almost racing by spreadsheet, isn't it? You know, you get this idea of when you're watching an online cycling race, people are just watching those numbers like a hawk rather than watching the actual racing. People are just focused on watching the numbers.
Guilty.
Well, everybody's guilty of it. You know, that's just how it's panned out. And, you know, whilst I appreciate that some people like watching a spreadsheet, and that's good for those people, we're trying to create something that is more like real life cycling, and therefore, instead of displaying those numbers, we display other things that are essentially equivalent, but far more realistic. So things like your actual speed, which of course you can just see anyway from how the riders move on screen, but also your effectively your percentage effort. So whether you are going hard for you. So it might be a relatively weak rider might be putting out might be doing a sprint, and that will show them as doing a sprint, and a relatively strong rider who might be doing exactly the same watts or even the exact same watts per kilo, but if they're within themselves and they're not really trying because they're that much stronger rider, then it will show them as just kind of sitting up and riding around. So showing people's relative effort compared to themselves is actually a much better way of judging how fast other people are going and how you should react to the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I spend my life obsessing over these numbers, not only on the right-hand side of the screen, but that actually leads me on to the next question, because obviously, I mean, I've got a number of favourites stored in my browser here that every Tuesday night or whatever day I'm racing, I'm immediately on one of the ranking systems, Zwift Power, for example, to see what we've done and where the rankings are and so on. But again, just tell us a little bit of background on your categorization and how the rankings work, because it seems very different and it's all built into the system as well.
Yeah, everything is actually built in right from the ground, right from day one. And it's all based around winning and losing. Essentially, it's based on your results. So you can be a super strong rider, but if you always lose, then you're going to be going to have a really low rating. But equally, if you're a really canny rider, you might not be the strongest person, but if you're always winning, you're going to get placed against much, much stronger opposition. And it comes back to that. There was actually an interview with Mark Cavendish a couple of weeks ago where he was talking around him not being the strongest rider in the peloton, but he regularly wins just because he's more intelligent about how he positions himself and when he applies that his kind of devastating sprint. And the whole way that Indivelo is set up around your ranking being based on your actual winning and losing record is just so much more realistic to create even racing, such that you get a a high quality race against people who are your same ability as yourself.
Chris, I'm getting some hope from this. It's not just going to be based on pure numbers now. These high B's, low A's, where you and I both sit, it gives me some hope. Maybe I can outfox these wattage monsters that we've been getting beat by.
Actually, I'm not as happy about this as you are, because I make up for my lack of strength and my ability to play the game. So I'm going to be racing against people that are not only strong, but they're also able to play the game.
Yeah, but you're going to get rewarded from being able to play the game. That's what George is saying.
Yeah, it sounds great, Si. It really does. I'm not so sure it works out. But anyway, another one of the things that's really innovative and built into the game is the event organization. Tell us quickly about that, because then I want to get into the heart of what you have going on, which is the racing.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've built into IndieVelo is the idea that anybody can just set up a race. So we provide everybody with the tools that you can put on whatever race you want, whenever you want. You can just go into a screen, set what course you want, how many laps you want, even what type of race you want, whether you want a points race or a scratch race or an elimination race or a time trial or whatever it is. You can set that up. You can configure each of the locations. So, for example, if you wanted to put on a points race, you can specify how many points you want at each arch. And then you just pick a time, write a description and hit go, and it just gets added to the schedule. So everybody can come join the race. It means that you've got that flexibility so that you can race your way when you want to.
And I do want to come on to some racing and a bit more about the verification anti-cheating, but just a couple more questions there from my point of view. This week, I'm not sure if you've seen it, Chris, but on social media, all I've seen in the last couple of days, I mean, first of all, we got our team kit on the IndieVelo platform very, very quickly, George, and I thought I got some special treatment, but I have noticed how quickly you're onboarding or members of the community are managing to onboard the kit so quickly. And is that just because of the way that you've got the system set up?
Yes, definitely. One of the kind of design goals was to make sure that people could come join and ride around in their team kits as easily as possible. So it's literally a question of that. We've got a template, you draw your team kit into that template, you send it to me, I upload it, takes 5 minutes. So yeah, we've been onboarding teams incredibly quickly.
You know, it's funny, Si, you know, not too many people know that behind the scenes, my son designed your in-game jersey, and it has the Zamuna K logo on it, which I'm very grateful. And it seems like it took my son and I longer to design the template than it took George to create it and put it into the game. But it just goes to show the great work that's going on. All right, so let's move on to the racing. And at the heart of the racing is, as you mentioned earlier, after talking to a number of racers, that it needs to be credible. So a skeptic that's looking in on this from the outside, maybe a racer on Zwift, they might be saying to themselves, well, if these guys are at Zwift and there were high profile cheating scandals there, what's stopping those things from happening at IndieVelo?
So the IndieVelo has basically been built with this in mind right from day one. And there are a large number of things built into the infrastructure to help with detecting and preventing cheating. Obviously, I'm not going to go into exactly what but a lot of things around design, actually. So if we come back to what we're talking about, the ranking and rating system, if you are going faster than you should be or you are naturally capable of, and it doesn't matter whether that's because you're deliberately cheating or maybe your equipment is miscalibrated. Because you are being rated and ranked and just auto-matchmaked into a pen of people of the similar ability as you, if you're going faster than you should be, then it doesn't actually help, because all it means is that the next race you end up racing against people who are exactly the same speed you are and have the a similar win-loss ratio you are. You haven't gained anything at all from cheating. So things like sandbagging and what have you are just designed out of the system. And it's that kind of making sure that cheating doesn't help you. It doesn't gain you any benefit. Designing that into the system is a key part of it. But also, and again, I'm not going to go into the details, there's an awful lot of the other stuff that you might expect as well. So a lot of CP modeling, looking at people's abilities, what they are physically capable of, understanding how they're progressing over time, to be able to really understand and get into the physiology of what a person is able to do, or what is real and what is realistic for them, so that we can automatically detect and flag people for review in real time.
That's great, but it doesn't explain what would happen at the sports elite level. There's no sandbagging at the sports elite level. You know, that's where all those high profile cheating scandals happen. So all of that stuff doesn't really, you know, it's great for the community racing and the lower levels, which is, you know, let's just face it, in many ways, it's the Wild West on Zwift, and that we just take it because they can't, you know, devote their resources to that. But you're basing your platform on that. So, you know, just speak about that just for a moment, if you could.
Yeah, definitely. And you're right to pick out that elite level as being materially different. And for that elite level, as I mentioned before, it's about identifying what people are truly capable of and painting a picture. So in much the same way as for anti-doping and the biological passport program, where you are taking data from an athlete over a very long period of time, over multiple different sources, whether it be blood tests and urine tests or power tests or whatever else, you're building up a picture of what this athlete's physiology is actually like, such that if they then go and outperform that, then you can flag it instantly. And it's the same with elite racing on Indy Velo. So we're building up this data bank of what athletes are capable of when riding online, but we can supplement that with what they're capable of in real life as well. So we can get real life data, merge that with the digital data from the platform or from other platforms as well, and merge that together to create a really good, well-rounded view of what people are actually capable of and when they're exceeding that.
With the announcement of Indy Velo going into beta, there's been a lot of chatter, a lot of talk, a lot of discussion around your place on the landscape as opposed to the other major platforms. And a lot of really interesting philosophical questions. You know, those are the things that really interest me. And I'd like to bring up a couple of those. And the first thing I want to ask you in that respect is, do you consider Indy Velo to be a direct competitor to Zwift?
No, is the short answer to that. I don't see it as a zero-sum game. It's not a case of if Indy Velo gains a user, then another platform loses one. What we're aiming to do is to provide something different. We're aiming to provide high quality training and racing for people who really care about it being tactically interesting and really care about the accuracy of results. And that's not that's not for everybody, and it's not for, and even for the people who it is for, it's not for them all the time. You know, everybody likes to go and have fun. You know, it's in Zwift's slogan, fun is fast, and they're right. You know, other platforms provide something different, and zooming around, going over boost pads and collecting tokens and what have you, that looks awesome fun. It's Indy Velo is providing something different to what the other platforms are providing. We're providing hugely credible tactical racing, and I genuinely believe that we can all these platforms can exist together, and we are really happy to go and help other platforms in implementing this. And ultimately, I think Indievelo's future is more likely to be aligned with the likes of WADA, ITA, UCI, and so on. You know, bodies that define what the sport is and how it is run to ensure credibility. That kind of incubator of technology and really pushing the boundaries of what is possible where a commercial operator might not want to invest in that area because it's only really appropriate for a relatively small number of users compared to chasing after, you know, the Peloton crowd, for want of a better term. So, yeah, I see Indievelo as being that service provider almost. So we generate that technology, which will hopefully push us towards the Olympics. And we are very willing to work with rather than against other platforms and anyone who shares that vision of trying to get racing to a higher level.
So I'm just thinking about this Olympic dream, for example. So you could see a time, for example, where, let's say, another organization, not Zwift, not Indievelo, not any of the other platforms out there, for example, but a third-party organization could go to one organization and say, hey, we want your visuals. We want this aspect of the way your game platform, whatever it might be, is. But we want this engine. We want this format from three or four different parties. You could see that happening in the future.
Well, that's exactly what happens in real life, isn't it, for real life cycling. You know, a company comes along and they say, right, well, we're going to have Tissot for the timing and we're going to have Skoda for the cars and we're going to use the roads from the, you know, French Department of Transport or whatever it is. Yeah, absolutely. It comes back to that point that we're talking about before around specialization, that Indievelo's purpose here is to provide that core infrastructure to make online racing tactically interesting and highly credible. But we recognize that no one company can do everything. You've got to specialize in what you're good at. As I said, we want to make physical esports a full medal sport at the Olympics, and we'll work with anyone who shares that goal. We're happy to integrate our technology with anyone who wants their platform to have that.
We've done a lot to speak about Indievelo, and we've really painted it in a very, very positive light. But there are a lot of skeptics out there, and there are a number of areas that they're skeptical about. You know, they have questions about. So I'm going to list off these things, and I want you to just give me your reaction. We've heard things about the name. The name isn't a esports cycling place name that I want to go and ride. I'm not an Indieveloer. I'm a Zwifter, right? The branding, you know, that comes up. The graphics, the bots. I don't know whether I'm riding against a human or a bot. And the big one, which is critical mass, the community. Maybe you could respond to those for us.
Yeah, of course. So in terms of the kind of the name and the branding and the graphics, we've kind of talked about that already. That's not been the focus. That's not what we're all about. We're all about the underlying infrastructure. And I see that an Olympic bid in the future will actually be bringing together all these different components. And what Indievelo is doing is investing in that infrastructure side of it. It's investing in the physics, it's investing in the pack dynamics, it's investing in the way that racing dynamics pans out in performance verification, all these kind of back end services. And if you spread yourself too thin, if you try and do all the fancy graphics and do all of those things, then you end up pleasing nobody. It's a question of really focusing in on your niche.
And as far as, you know, the bots, like I rode around today and I was chatting with myself, but I was surrounded by it. I was surrounded by a bunch of riders, and they were acting like real human riders would, as if I was, you know, on Zwift with Coco, right? I was doing Pacer. So, you know, just speak about that. And then, you know, eventually what's going to draw people in is that there are other people that they can interact with, you know, speak to that.
Yeah, I think the bots are actually really important, and they're important for racing in particular. So we're all used to entering a race and there only being one other person who's entered as well. And that's not a good workout. It's kind of boring to race one other person over a 40-kilometer ride or something. By having the bots, it ensures that you always get a full field. You can rock up at 2 o'clock in the morning, if that's your thing, and have a race with 200 others, and get a really good workout and be really stretched, which after all is the point of this. You know, people use these platforms for training and they want to have a nice hard ride, and the bots ensure that you get that. And you mentioned the idea of them being human-like, and One of the things that I hear quite often is I can't tell the difference between it, whether it's a human or a bot. And I treat that as an enormous compliment, actually. The fact that they are lifelike, they've got their own phenotypes. So there are sprinters and there are time trialers and there are wheel suckers and all these kind of different types of AIs that are built in. They've all got their own energy systems, which means you can tire them out. Quite often in a points race, they'll go off very hard and win the first few sprints, and gradually you can wear them down, and eventually towards the end of the race, you can start beating them, unless they wear you down first. I'd say it's actually all part of this kind of training dynamic to make sure that you as a racer and as an elite rider, you get a really excellent workout every single time that you enter a race.
Yeah, I was going to say, Chris, I've raced in some of these races and I could not tell which was a bot. And I couldn't figure out, because obviously the bots we're used to riding with are single pace bots on other platforms. So the fact that I joined a race and it was pretty dynamic, to be honest, I was just convinced it was another rider for my own sanity. I was convinced it was another rider just trying to break me down there. But I think in terms of community, obviously you said there that the community have helped to develop this platform, and we've seen in this last couple of days, you know, I am part of that Discord community now and I can see a lot of the chat going on. So is it still just you that's on a daily basis reviewing and implementing all those features that are raised? You know, how do you go about picking which features that the community inevitably are going to keep throwing up as the community grows, that which stay and which go?
By listening, quite honestly. I 100% of the Indivelo roadmap is determined by what its users want. We, as I said before, we all share that same vision, focus, drive, and we're building something amazing together. And I spend probably half my time just chatting with other riders, trying to understand what they want. And can you imagine that in pretty much any other, any other industry, let alone any other cycling platform? You know, half of the entire company's time is spent chatting to other riders and finding out what they want and then going and implementing it.
Well, I have to tell you, I've learned a lot, Si, and I'm sure that you have also. Is there anything that you'd like to say to Dr. Gilbert before we just wrap it up? I have one last question, and I want to get a one-word answer from you to finish us off here.
No, you go ahead, Chris. I'm worn out from all the intelligent chat on astrophysics and programming, for sure.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Gilbert is also, and I'm extremely gracious that you came on with us and that we're open with all these things. So I have one last question. Just want a one word answer. Will cycling esports ever become an Olympic medal sport?
slightly longer answer, then I'll come back to it. But that really reminds me of a great quote from
We have less than 1 minute, Dr. Gilbert, so you're on the clock.
It really reminds me of this great quote from Cool Runnings where John Candy says, a gold medal is a wonderful thing, but if you're not enough without it, you'll never be enough with it. It's not about the Olympics. The Olympics is our North Star, a guiding light that inspires us. It directs our decisions. We don't have to reach it to succeed. It's the journey that's important. But yeah.
I'd like to thank you for the privilege of your time and for helping to bridge the gap between athlete and avatar.